You are listening to WEFT Champagne 90.1 FM, and of course you can stream us online at weft.org. That track I just played was the Dropkick Murphys from their album. Let me check. I believe I have it right in front of me right here. It's the Dropkick Murphys, that's for sure. if it's dedicated to Joe Strummer, Brian... well, Dropkick Murphys, Blackout. Excuse me, sorry about that. Blackout is the album of that Dropkick Murphys worker. The tune Workers Song. And you're going to have a bit of a couple of themes today. One of them being workers just to remind, this is the let me introduce myself and what this program is. This is where we are at. My name is Ben. I'll be your host for the next hour. And just a reminder that the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker. They do not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champagne, Prayer Air Incorporated, Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WEFT Associates. The date is Monday, July 11th, 2022. I hope you are enjoying your Monday, whether you're getting, I guess it's summer, so there's probably no school classes, unless if it's summer school, if you're getting off work, or maybe, who knows, maybe you worked a late shift, maybe you're just about to start work. But today, there was a rally slash strike by AFSCME, who are over their contract negotiations. Dozens of them showed up today at the Champaign County Courthouse in Urbana, and they're supposed, I believe they are negotiating their contract. The speaker there, who you were, was there, captured some of the audio, and a lot of people, quite a few people showed up. And this is just a bit of a taste of that rally. I got it queued up. So this is the AFSCME rally over contract negotiations from earlier today.
So far, and we're going into negotiations tomorrow to try to finish this. So we want to first of all thank you for coming, donating your time so that you could actually be out here and you know, scream for us and be loud, because without you guys we wouldn't be here. And you know, it's been a real fight and struggle this whole contract, so hopefully tomorrow we can actually make some progress and keep things moving. We have the interest of all of our members, you know, foremost, so we just want to thank you all for coming. Great event. Thank you.
Our father was a union man someday. All he wants to do. The boss is fired. Daddy wants our family gone.
So I can never resist anytime there's any kind of strike, rally, workers, pro-workers, you know, in this case, AFSCME union rally. I always feel the need to play Which Side Are You On by Dropkick Murphys, which is from their album Sing Loud, Sing Proud. You see, had the knew the album that time, right away at least. But yes, I'll keep you all up to date on the AFSCME contract negotiations here in Champaign County. That should be really interesting to keep up. Now, yesterday, the Party for Socialism and Liberation held a forum on reproductive rights, obviously with what's been going on with the Supreme Court, which essentially overturned Roe v. Wade, and now it leaves the decision of having an abortion up to the state. And a lot of states, as I've mentioned earlier, have essentially made getting an abortion illegal. States such as, I believe, Alabama, Oklahoma, Ohio, and so the Party for Socialism Liberation had a forum at the, I believe, Independent Media Center yesterday, and this was just part of that forum of people talking about the history of abortion here in the United States and all the and some of them give about their own experiences as well. So I have that audio queued up here. Hopefully the levels should be good. I do apologize if it comes up a little bit loud. I'm a bit shaky today. See, that's what happens when you don't you're not always doing a live show every weekend. This is the Party for Socialism and Liberation Reproductive Rights Forum.
The federal government is no longer responsible for guaranteeing our rights and instead has passed down control to state representatives. In other words, we no longer have constitutional protections for our right to control our own bodies. The attacks to the right for safe abortions come from the racist, sexist, transphobic, homophobic, capitalist system of government of the United States. For example, if the Supreme Court is the bastion of democracy it is always lauded to be, why does it blatantly ignore the will of the people? According to the Pew Research Center, a majority of Americans believe abortion should be legal in most, if not all, cases from 2011 to 2022 this year. In a true democracy, people's voices would be heard and our rights to safe abortions would be protected. But the truth is that the Supreme Court is undemocratic and has always been used to subjugate the working class and oppressed people of this country. And this extends to the entirety of our government, both Republicans and Democrats, because they serve the needs of the wealthy that profit off of our labor, not the working class that produces that labor. Reproductive justice, women's and femmes' liberation, and queer liberation necessitates building a powerful working class movement to secure fundamental and reproductive rights. That is, we need to build a strong socialist movement to fight the root cause, capitalism. Each panelist here today represents a local organization leading our movement for reproductive justice in this framework. In a moment, our panelists will introduce themselves, the organizations they represent, and speak about the injustice brought on by the American government against reproductive rights and the struggle of a working class movement to follow. Afterwards, we will engage in discussion. I would now like to invite Carla to the podium.
Hola a todos, todas y todes. Hello to everyone. My name is Carla Sanabria Vegas. I am currently the co-president of the Graduate Employees Organization with my colleague, Nachiketa Alicari, who is also joining us today. I'm very excited to join this panel with all of you. My pronouns are she, her, hers, and in Spanish, ella. Thank you.
Thank you, Carla. I would now like to invite McCare to the stand.
Hi, everyone. Can you hear me? Okay. Hi, my name is McCare. I use she, they pronouns, and I'm a community organizer with PSL. going to call me Matrix. My pronouns are they, them, and I am a person, I'm a freedom fighter. You can call me a community activist, activist, not too concerned at all. I'm fighting for the freedom of my people, whatever way I have the capacity to do so. Currently, I am also involved with TSL, in a banner campaign, and a group of folks that refer to themselves as Black Students for Revolution.
I would like to invite anyone right now who has like a speech prepared or just would like to speak on the topic of reproductive justice in our...
Hello, hello everyone. So, I think for those of you that know me, know that I love to start anything that I do with chanting, and that's exactly what we're going to do right now. And this is actually a chant that I... learned in Spanish with the feminist movement in Puerto Rico. I'm Puerto Rican, born and raised, which is a colony of the U.S. that has been fighting over the last 120 years for its socialist sovereignty and independence. And, Romy, I have 10 minutes, right? Less than 10 minutes or something like that. Yeah, I'm going to time myself so that way I won't take time from the other panelists. But the basically, the chant that I would like us to do now to start the panel is very simple. It reads, free abortions, we refuse to die. Our ultimate decision is by me, myself, and I. And it goes like this. Free abortions, we refuse to die. The ultimate decision is by me, myself, and I. Free abortions, we refuse to die. The ultimate decision is by me, myself, and I. That last part of that chant, because in 2020, according to the Pew Research Center that Romy also cited today, particularly the Gematria Institute for Research in Reproductive Justice, they mentioned that in 2020, 930,160 abortions were made in the U.S. If abortion is not free, it is not accessible, women and people with uteruses that can't get pregnant, their bottom line is their lives. But there is a reason why, as Romy mentioned at the beginning, particularly women and people with uteruses, people that don't identify as male, have been very much tied with this alienation of not being able to decide over our own bodies, over our own life. In 2019, most of the abortions made in the U.S. were from people that already gave birth and were already mothers or caregivers, but hadn't had an abortion, not even for the first time. However, 37 states require some parental involvement, particularly for minors that are getting an abortion. Only 16 states use public funds to support abortion, and 45 states allow refusal for practitioners or for physicians to say, I'm not going to operate an abortion for whatever religious belief or particular individuality over the collective right towards our bodies and towards our freedom. And in a capitalist society, we need to remind ourselves that it is because how women have been associated with the reproduction of life itself, it is that particular reason why the government is so concerned with our particular bodies, even though it doesn't give a damn of public education, of rights for workers, of decent and even wages in this country, but it's very particularly concerned with the right of women and people with uterus to decide over our own bodies, because you can't have the reproduction of capitalism without the reproduction of life itself. And that is the bottom line. And that is why, as socialists today, as people that fight for the freedom of all the individuals that work for a living, for all of us that are freedom fighters, in this panel that we're convocated today, we need to think a little bit more about what are the current conditions that we have as organizers, And what does those conditions tell us in terms of the contradictions facing our organizing? And in terms of how do we enact progress beyond social change, right? I'm particularly still haven't necessarily, I grasp every day the decision and the impact of Roe versus Wade on how once again we see the attack of a capitalist state funded by the rich and funded by a liberal ideology that keeps perpetuating private property over the ownership, the socialized ownership of the labor that we produce as workers. And that needs to be very much central in all of our decisions. And I'm going to end this part of my intervention with my own testimonial and how did I actually gain that perspective. On June 8th of 2016, I did an abortion back home in Puerto Rico because when I was 21 years old, I told to myself that my life was important and my collective responsibility in the organizing that I was doing was my priority because I take my social emancipation as a woman, as an individual that can be more than just a mother, very seriously. And I respect the capacity and decision of mothers of wanting to do that and wanting to create a family, but I also understand that families do not only limit itself to family blood relationships. We need to think about, in this current society, how do we think about adoption? How do we think about friends bringing together children and other possibilities of family? Abortion is extremely inaccessible in Puerto Rico. My partner at the time, myself, we paid over $300 for just the pill abortion process. I had a doctor that told me that I should be very much ashamed of myself. And when I asked, the picture after the process told me that I wouldn't be proud of the decision that I was making over my own body. But most importantly, at the end of that process, I thought about this idea of my decision, my choice, and how we can read that from a very liberal perspective versus my decision, my choice, and how do we read that as an exercise of social autonomy? Because it's not only that it's my body, my choice, and I don't understand the material conditions surrounding that discussion, and I don't understand how I have been subjugated to the labor of the reproduction of life for the reproduction of capitalism, but how I understood at that moment, despite all the pictures of fetuses that I was shown in my Catholic school and my upbringing, and all the pressure that I received from my family and other friends, I understood that I, as a human being, had the capacity to recognize my own role in history, to transform my conditions, and to transform the conditions of other women. Because maternity has to be desired, or maternity cannot be, period. In that instance. And to finalize my intervention, I just want to say, right, going back to Rosa Luxemburg, which is one of my favorite socialists as well, left without feminism lacks death, but feminism without the left lacks strategy. It is very important that all of the people here today, if you are from a nonprofit organization, in my case, a union or whatever organization we represent here today, we need to understand that the reason why these right-wing conservative people are advancing is because the left is not sufficiently organized in these current conditions. And when we say left, it's any individual that understands that, first of all, exploitation is not natural. Exploitation is created by these current conditions. And secondly, individual solutions, if our problems are collective, we cannot afford individual solutions. And that's why we need the ideology, the political program, and the organization to combat this, because the right is organized. Where are we? So with that, I'm going to finish it up today and leave it up for our other panelists. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Carla. I greatly resonated with the fact that the emphasis on the left having to organize, especially around such an impactful issue that touches all of our lives to some degree. I would now like to invite Tatu to speak.
Woo-hoo!
seats. I just want to thank everyone for coming out today. This spaces like this are, your bodies are necessary. Your bodies are valuable, and I see you, and I appreciate you taking your time out to slide today, and thank you all for existing. Every person is beautiful. Thank you so much for that. In creating this speech, I found myself at a loss for words to begin, and I, coming from a place so frustrated, so enraged, so disheartened, so disappointed, am exhausted with the reminder as frequently as I check my timeline that the individuals whose salaries we pay for, whose positions in our government are not following through with what our needs are and what's best for the people. But there was a tweet that inspired the message that I would like to communicate to you all today on Twitter. Shout out to the artist. They said something along the lines of, the forest was getting smaller, but the trees kept voting for the axes to save them. And seeing that made me freeze, because I thought about it, it's irony. I thought seeing that at this point in time, in our status quo, was refreshing. Such a beautiful analogy. Axes. Our elected officials, the individuals that we put in positions of power to make decisions on our behalf, are actively harming our bodies frequently, are actively making decisions that directly result in the death and harm of millions of people. So if I was in a fairy tale story and I was a character in a forest that was being hurt, I was in that community, I would communicate in whatever way or articulation that would best communicate the urgency and the importance of recognizing that these individuals that we're voting for, that we're hoping to incite change, do not have our best interests at heart. And that isn't a result of the system that they're a part of being broken. I say to anyone who will listen to me, the system is not broken. It is doing exactly what it was designed to do. It's doing exactly what it was engineered to do. When we have an economic system that requires debt and that requires conditions of poverty for economic prosperity, that requires the sacrifice of the working class, of the sacrifice of the work and efforts of a great majority of a community to be benefiting the lives of a handful of wealthy people who are also making decisions about the lives of those people that they're participating in systems to harm, it feels so obvious, it feels so apparent for us to acknowledge and say to ourselves, our president is not going to save us. Our sheriffs, these individuals that we, these careers that we believe or are inclined to believe that are, whose fulfillment of their job involves protecting and serving, are not going to protect us. They're not here to serve us. And so it is imperative that we educate ourselves. Revolution has to happen within yourself first. Self-education is extremely important. So please, if you do not have the capacity to purchase books to begin studying on your own, please find an organization in your community that is exercising political education, PSL, that is providing spaces for political education, BSFR, and individuals that refer to themselves as imagining freedom. It's imperative to educate yourself about the systems that are perpetuating your harm, perpetuating your subjugation. And I just want to express, in addition to educating oneself about how all of our social issues that we have are unsolvable under the capitalistic system. Why else would individuals who are, their role is to not only contribute to this illusion of the checks and balances that we have in this country, but to respond to injustices and return it with an act or a verdict of reinforcing that equality, reinforcing that equity, make a decision that majority of people, majority of Americans, express that they didn't want. They're not going to save us. It's going to require our fight and our individual will and our mobilization as communities to take that which is rightfully ours and fight for our freedom, because we're not going to, and in the words of Audre Lorde, we're not going to be able to dismantle the master's house with the master's tools. We're not going to be able to vote our way out of this because we don't live in a democracy. This is not a land of the people. This is not a governmental system that makes decisions based on the needs and the desires of the people that they are in positions to serve, because our politicians are in the hands of banks and corporations. That's what they're willing to buy. They're willing to buy. They do not lie with us. Their prioritization, going home and laying over or going over their documents to, or new legislative documents to look over, how they make decisions and where they place their vote is not based upon what's best for us as a community. Their actions, they're gonna harm us when they come into the forest, when they come into our community, when they make decisions. It's directly to harm. You will not go into a forest trying to build it swinging an axe. That sounds silly to say, right? Doesn't make sense to me. So I think relying on these systems to provide us with some kind of tangible social change feels just as silly. Feels just like a waste of time as we continue to increase in mortality rates, as our bodies continue to be harmed. And this fight that we have ahead of us is not one that is going to be a destination, but a journey. Not a race, but a marathon. And so I end my speech with just reiterating how imperative it is to educate yourself about these systems that are harming our bodies, about educate yourself about capitalism, educate yourself about fascism and how it's the means with which governments in this country and other countries reenact that and uphold white supremacy and other forms of social government, and how capitalism and the need for countries like the U.S., these big global superpowers, harming and actively committing to the murder of political leaders in other countries that are capitalists, that are leftists, that are prioritizing the well-being of the community that they're overlooking. And two, second, get involved with individuals who are organizing. Now, what does that mean specifically for you? Depends on whatever capacity you have. It depends on whatever resource you have access to, whatever time you have, right? Because this fight is not going to be, you know, in these spaces are people, you know, there's an immense strain on the working class, on this majority that is contributing to the wealth of the top 1%. So it's not going to be easy. So self-care routines and checking in with what you have the bandwidth for is going to be imperative, but that does not mean you cannot fight. It does not mean there is not a place in the fight for you. I promise you, there is. And third, as we begin on this journey, it's going to be extremely important to withdraw from responsibilities as you no longer have the capacity. Burnout is real, and I think that one of the most tangible effects of this pandemic that we survived is the strain, are the wounds that we acquired along that process, and the mass death. So please be respectful of that, and thank you all for your time.
Just a reminder that the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and don't necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, the station management, the board of directors, or the WEFT associates is just about at the half hour mark, 6:30. And I'm just going to play some public service announcements, and then we'll continue with the rest of the show here of where we are at here on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. And well, I think these are pre-recorded public service announcements, so this might they might come off a little redundant. So here are some public service announcements from here from us at WEFT.
Here are some public service announcements. The CU at Home Men's Emergency Shelter is provided year-round, 365 days a year. Intakes begin at 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. Service is provided at CU at Home at 70 East Washington Street in Champaign, which is the former Times Center location. Light snacks are available. Showers and laundry are available in emergency situations. You can contact Thomas Welt. The phone number is 217-819-4569. Again, the phone number, 217-819-4569. You could also call 217-649-2200. Again, that phone number, 217-649-2200. After business hours and need shelter, call the CU at Home Outreach Hotline. That phone number is 217-888-0329. And again, that last one, the CU at Home Outreach Hotline, phone number 217-888-0329. There is also Austin's Place, which is a shelter for women, which provides overnight emergency shelter for women year-round. Intakes begin at 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. This resource is housed at CU at Home's 70 East Washington Street facility in Champaign, which is the former Times Center building. Light snacks are provided. Showers and laundry are also available. For more information, you can contact Chloe Hansen. The phone number is 217-819-4569. Again, that phone number, 217-819-4569. They also have a website, CU at Home, which you can Google. It would probably just be possible to Google CU at Home, shelterAustin'sPlace.weebly.com. And after business hours is the same number, is the same phone number as before that I read a few minutes ago. CU at Home, outreach hotline, 217-888-0329. Again, that phone number is 217-888-0329. The Daily Bread Soup Kitchen's mission is to feed the hungry in our community. Currently, they provide a hot, nutritional meal in a biodegradable clamshell box plus a hearty sack lunch to go from 11 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. 7 days a week. Because of COVID-19, though, they cannot currently offer inside dining. The Daily Bread Soup Kitchen is located on 116 North 1st Street in Champaign. Their phone number is 217-356-7687. Their website is Daily Bread Soup Kitchen, all one word, dailybreadsoupkitchen.com. And again, they are located on 116 North 1st Street in Champaign, and they offer a free sack lunch to go from 11 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. 7 days a week, and we thank them for their hospitality and for the work that they have been doing. For rental assistance, you can go to the Champaign County Regional Planning Commission. If you would like, their website is ccrpc.org, and then when you get onto the website, you'll go to Programs and Services, and then click on Emergency Rent Assistance. But yes, Champaign County Regional Planning Commission, again, that website, ccrpc.org. Please consider supporting the programming you love. WEFT will gladly accept that vehicle you've been looking to get rid of. Our vehicle donation program provides an effortless option to support WEFT Community Radio. You can give CARS, C-A-R-S, Charitable Adult Rides and Services, a call at 1-855-500-4255.
CARIDE, or fill out the secure donation form at CAREASY, CAREASY.org. Just remember to designate WEFT as the nonprofit beneficiary of your gift. WEFT truly appreciates supporters like you. If you're wondering what is showing at the Virginia Theater in Champaign, you can look up updates that are posted as soon as they become available. For more information, go to the Virginia Theater website, the Virginia, all one word, thevirginia.org, thevirginia.org. You can also call their phone number, 217-356-9063. Again, that phone number is 217-356-9063. You can also email them at virginia@champagneparks.org. Just a reminder that the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WEFT Associates. We'll do it with public service announcements. We only have about 20 minutes left, so I'll just play some of the last week's on the ground, which covers what's essentially, I think, some of the will be covering the Supreme Court and recent news of what's been going on there. So let me just stop talking and cue up that audio. It should be all ready. So this is On the Ground.
From Washington, D.C., this is On the Ground.
If July 4th, 1776 ignited this sturdy so-called democratic experiment, why are we on the brink of fascism? Why do we have revelations about a sawdust Caesar, speaking of the 45th U.S. president, marching with an armed mob to Capitol Hill on January 6, 2021, with the intent of overthrowing a legitimate election?
It took the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to move the Constitution toward even some semblance of a useful document in terms of human equality. Go where you may, search where you will. Roam through all the monarchies and despotisms of the old world, travel through South America, search out every abuse, and when you have found the last, lay your facts by the side of the everyday practices of this nation, and you will say with me that for revolting barbarity and shameless hypocrisy, America reigns without a rival.
Welcome to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, voices of resistance from the nation's capital. I'm Esther Averam. Well, with recent extreme rulings by the U.S. Supreme Court, striking down abortion rights, gun safety laws, and the power of the federal government to curb fossil fuel emissions, even politicians are describing what is happening in the U.S. as a judicial coup. And many Americans felt they had little to celebrate on this year's Independence Day holiday. Combine those high court rulings with testimony that former President Trump planned to march with armed protesters to the U.S. Capitol on January 6th and ongoing police and right-wing violence, and it's all enough for our geopolitical analyst, Professor Joan Horn, to conclude that the U.S. is entering an era of pre-fascism, with more violence, including state-sponsored violence, at home and wars abroad. 3 days after last week's show, Gerald Horn participated on an Independence Day holiday special titled The Farce of You Lie on the Pacifica show To Heal DC, hosted by Joni Eisenberg on WPFW in Washington, DC. In conversation with Professor Greg Carr of Howard University, Gerald connects the dots between current events and U.S. history, including references to his most recent work, The Counter-Revolution of 1836, Texas Slavery and Jim Crow, and the Roots of U.S. Fascism. We devote this hour to conversation on the show with Gerald Horn, author of more than 40 books, and the Moores Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston, and Greg Carr, Associate Professor of Africana Studies and Chair of the Department of Afro-American Studies at Howard University. We begin with Gerald Horn's opening remarks.
We need to ask the fundamental question, that is to say, why are we a few steps away from U.S. fascism in this country when on July 4th we're supposed to be celebrating and marking the anniversary of the creation of a sturdy democratic experiment? And yet we see that in light of the overthrow of Roe versus Wade, you have prosecutors in this country who are actually contemplating the death penalty for women who claim control of their bodies. When I saw a cartoon about arming the fetus, I didn't know whether or not to take it seriously or whether it was a satire. We have a high court that is in the process of strangling the Environmental Protection Administration, plunging this small planet into chaos. We have a Supreme Court that is unleashing even more weapons. Already we have more guns in this country than we have citizens. We have a Supreme Court that is seeking to encode a kind of white Christian nationalism in light of recent decisions, which obviously jeopardizes so-called religious minorities of whatever stripe. And this is all taking place in the last few days. Now, I think that in terms of what is to be done, to cut to the chase, part of the political problem in this country, and we will talk about how this eventuated, is that the Republicans have no compunction, no hesitation in embracing those to their right. In fact, you can see the Oath Keepers, the Proud Boys, the Three Percenters as the armed wing of the Republican Party, just as the Ku Klux Klan in the 19th century was the armed wing of the Democratic Party. The Democrats, by way of contrast, not only shun those to their left for the most part, but oftentimes join in the targeting of them. This has created an imbalance tipping to the right, which is one of the explanations of why we're tipping towards a unique brand of neo-fascism. And in terms of digging ourselves out of the deep hole in which we find ourselves, that would be one of the major issues to tackle. And let me make a particular point of addressing the population of African descent, because in some ways, July 4th, 1776, was an effort to build a nation on their backs, on the backs of enslaved Africans. And in this context, I'm afraid to say we have a rather obscene symbol of July 4th in terms of the late Jaylen Walker of Akron, Ohio. If you can stomach it, look at the video of these police officers shooting him dozens of times. And if you can't stomach it, at least read about it and try to do something about it. It's not enough to say the obvious, which is that this is a product of racism. It's not enough to say the obvious, which is that this is a legacy of slavery and Jim Crow. In order to get to the real nub of this crisis, you have to realize that Africans, as historians have acknowledged for decades, if not longer, did not engage in class collaboration by uniting shoulder to shoulder with their slave masters, George Washington, James Madison, Patrick Henry, Thomas Jefferson. Instead, by several orders of magnitude, of course, they opposed this lurch towards so-called independence. And when you fight a war and lose, which is basically what our ancestors did, you can expect to be pulverized and penalized forevermore unless and until you can turn the tables, which is what began to happen with the Haitian Revolution, which ignited a general crisis of the entire slave system that could only be resolved with its collapse, which it did finally after tremendous bloodshed in North America in 1865. Now, what's curious, and let me address this to our friends on the U.S. left, oftentimes our friends on the U.S. left, when it comes to analyzing the origins of the United States, they've engaged in opportunism, quite frankly. They've abandoned their battle station that supposedly privileges class struggle, because as noted, they do not necessarily conceptualize unpaid workers as an exploited class. And like any class, this class of exploited workers was not only straining to be free, but straining to seize power, which is what the Africans did in the Caribbean, 1791 to 1804. But they abandoned this idea of class struggle in order to fit Black people into this overarching U.S. narrative. And at the same time, they tend to ignore the question of class collaboration, which inheres in settler colonialism. You go back to the 1580s in what they called North Carolina, when the English settlers invaded Native American land. What's interesting is that this was a typical class collaborationist project. Europeans of various class backgrounds uniting under the 1% of London for mutual gain. You cannot begin to understand how 74, 75 million people voted in 2020 for a faux billionaire, most of the 74, 75 million resembling the original settlers, unless you understand this concept of class collaboration, which generally is not invoked with regard to settler colonialism. In fact, if you don't like the term settler colonialism, come up with another term that describes an invasion of a land and liquidating the original inhabitants. Now, I think it's also fair to say that the left has abandoned materialist analysis. Many of them salute the Bill of Rights, even though we know that the Second Amendment, which is causing so much havoc, these regulated militias were designed to put guns in the hands of settlers so they could repress Native American rebellions, repress rebellions of enslaved Africans. And this so-called vaunted First Amendment, which guarantees religious liberty, that was a way to escape the religious antagonisms that have wracked Europe, Protestant versus Catholic versus those of Jewish origin, in order to unite them all in this settler bloc that, yes, could further repress Native Americans and steal their land and enslave Africans. And even if you look at the Declaration of Independence, the ostensible cause for this celebration of July 4th, why is it that the framers, which, and I notice is published in newspapers all over the country today, oftentimes in small print, so you can't read what they actually say. Why are they supporting in the Declaration of Independence so-called domestic insurrections ignited by London? Might they be making reference to the fact that in Virginia, in the run-up to July 4th, 1776, the last British colonial governor, Lord Dunmore, was basically authorizing and organizing so-called Ethiopian regiments in order to repress the settlers' revolt. And speaking of that, let me say that listeners might be well advised, if they want a different view of the origins of this country, to look at the multi-part film, docudrama, Book of Negroes, co-produced by BET Canadian Broadcasting and South African Broadcasting, which has some of the most startling depictions of these settlers and their valued property that you can find in cinema. And of course, it was produced not necessarily by Hollywood. And speaking of settler revolts, as the social scientists might say, we have a control group north of the border. Canada did not revolt against British rule, and yet Canada has the initial emblem of attending to its citizenry by having single-payer healthcare system as opposed to this pay-or-die system that we have in the United States of America. And in terms of settler revolts, why don't these U.S. historians compare the settlers' revolt in North America to its peers, such as the one in Algeria in the run-up to Algerian independence in 1962, which shed copious amounts of blood? The only thing you can say in honor of 1776 is that, at least as far as we know, unlike the settlers in Algeria who tried to assassinate and decapitate the leadership in France, the colonial master, as far as we know, the settlers in North America did not try to assassinate and decapitate the leadership in London. Or what about Rhodesia, November 1965, when the settlers, led by the racist Ian Smith, said intentionally and consciously that they were walking in the footsteps of 1776 when they sought to secede from the British Empire, not least because they thought London was moving towards one person, one vote, African majority rule, just like the settlers, per the Somerset case of 1772, thought that London was moving to not only abolish slavery in England itself, which Somerset's case accomplished, but also that that decision would leapfrog the Atlantic and jeopardize the millions of dollars in property owned by slaveholders and real estate speculators like George Washington. Speaking of real estate speculators, and I'll close here, the other key to understanding 1776 is the so-called Royal Proclamation of 1762-1763, where London expressed displeasure at continuing to wage war against the Native Americans, seizing their land and turning it over to real estate speculators like George Washington. Rather than accede to these dual decisions with regard to land and labor, in a material sense, this is what triggered the revolt against British rule. This is what led to the United States of America. This is one of the reasons why 13 colonies on the eastern seaboard of North America began to expand relentlessly westward in succeeding decades, exemplifying the reasons they revolted in the first instance by continuing to seize Native American land, liquidating that population, and importing more Africans to the point where after 1776, the United States quickly surpassed Britain as the major slave trading nation, up to and including controlling the slave trade to Cuba as early as the 1790s, the slave trade to the biggest market of all, speaking of Brazil, by the 1840s, whereby London, after it lost its major market in North America, and after the Haitian Revolution made it realize that it was on the verge of losing its cash cows in Jamaica and Barbados, moved to abolish London's role in the African slave trade before the United States, the supposed democratic republican experiment, and then abolishing slavery itself in the Caribbean decades before the United States, which accomplished this goal by dint of bloodshed.
Yeah, I'm sitting here, as always, taking notes whenever Gerald Horn speaks. I think we would all be well due to do that. As I was thinking about what Gerald was saying, you know, I reflect on the fact that, as you know, I lived almost 20 years in Philadelphia, and I would tell students at Howard for the 10 years I lived there that I commuted to D.C. that every morning I get up in the city where they made up America and take the train to the city they made up for America. And if I were in Philly on July 4th, I would probably be down at the old Pennsylvania State House, which, of course, now is called Independence Hall. And there are two striking things I would always try to bear witness to. And many times I bring my Philadelphia Freedom School students down there with me. And I always carry a copy of Fred Douglass's speech, 1852 speech, with us. One was before the official ceremony in the front of Independence Hall, where they would give this Medal of Freedom. This is before they built the National Constitution Center. They would have a ceremony where they would bring out little children. And you see these little white children in Oxfords and khakis and blazers and little dresses. And they would all have on little white gloves, like they were getting ready to handle a precious document or something. And they would be announced. And it was a very small ceremony, to my surprise. It would never be more than maybe 100 people there, including the families. And the announcement would be made, these are the descendants of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. And they say, wait, what? And then they would give them a little soft-headed mallet. And then they would proceed to where the Liberty Bell was headed. And one by one, I'm not talking about 30-year-olds, 50-year-olds, 60-year-olds. I'm talking about 7, 8, 9, 10-year-olds, 12-year-olds. They would take them to the Liberty Bell. And one by one, they would strike the edge of the Liberty Bell with that soft mallet. And it always struck me that, now, I'm sure there were some black children that could be included in that, but it would have created a great scandal, you understand, because if you had traced where some of those signers had been in terms of the slave quarters, then, you know, it would have been quite scandalous. But anyway, the thing that would always strike me was, as you just said, Gerald, they would read the entire Declaration of Independence, and including the line when these white nationalists breaking from their parents in England accused the crown of rising insurrections against us. In other words, crucifying the Native Americans and Africans for trying to fight their own liberation, something, as we know, the lawyer Francis Scott Key reiterated in his Star Spangled Banner when he said the hireling and the slave, you know, that song wasn't for us. They would cheer. And I said, look at these people cheering against me, and the children with the mallet in their hand cheering against me. So that's the one of the two. But the second thing that evoked, as I was thinking, listening to you, Gerald, was, of course, then the formal ceremony would start. And for many of those years, there was a black mayor of Philadelphia. They would always have a black choir. And Fred Douglass, of course, asks, he says, they that carried us off captive required of us a song. And it raises this question, as I think about, Gerald, not only the counter-revolution of 1776, which you brilliantly extended with your book, The Counter-Revolution of 1836, but it reminds me of two other books that you wrote. And you recall when we were in Atlanta for the unveiling of the W.E.B. Du Bois bust there at the Clark Atlanta University Center, I remember you standing with Alden Morris and myself and a few others, and Amiri Baraka was there signing some copies of his poems. And you were explaining to us your project to back map this contemporary founding of the U.S. moment. And of course, subsequently would appear two books, The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism and The Dawning of the Apocalypse, where...
I unfortunately have to end that there as we are getting to the end of the hour. Just a reminder that the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WEFT Associates. And just to let you know, if you miss any of this program or if you are interested in any of the other Public Archives show, like for instance, Radio Theater is coming up after my show, you can go to our website, weft.org, and catch all of, a lot of our programs, including obviously including our music shows and our other public affairs shows. We also have a donation page, you know, if you want to donate to us, since we are a publicly run, you know, a volunteer run radio station, you can go to our website, weft.org, and find out all about all of that information there. But I have to, I'm going to end the show here. I'm going to play Sidney Lauper's Sally's Pigeons. I believe the song came out in 1993, but this is Sidney Lauper from her 12. Cue it up here. 12 Deadly Guns album. But thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back. Hopefully, I'll be back here next week. But thank you very much for listening, and have a good night.
With a pirate smile. Make believe and play, pretend we were innocent and wild. Hop the fence and slam the gate, running down my alleyway. In time to watch Sally's pigeons fly. We love to watch them dive and soar, circle in the sky, free as a bird from 3 to 4, and never knowing why.